This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. This year, we were invited to return to the Beavertown Extravaganza to run the now annual symposium, bringing together brewers and leaders from all over the world to discuss the topics of the day, some of which inspire the industry, and some that keep it up at night. Last year's first ever symposium for the extravaganza covered the spread from terroir and beer to hazy IPA, and this year was no less ambitious. But the context for this year's symposium naturally shifted, as Beavertown's own ambitions came to light in the months leading up to their minority partnership with Heineken and the announcement of Beaverworld. Some brewers took offense and pulled out, others soldiered on, and still others rallied to their side and joined the festival, sending a clear message that, as the beer industry continues to evolve and grow more complex, the simple notions that once seemed to spur it on are perhaps not as simple as many thought, after all. The topics for this year's extravaganza followed naturally on that signal, covering topics such as how beer and wine are sold differently, the value of independence and investment, and of course, what is going to happen to Hazy IPA after all this. Congrats to Beavertown and their crew for forging ahead and throwing a spectacular event in the midst of a challenging time of change. Thanks for inviting us to come and co-host the symposium with you all. After all, the purpose of the symposium is to dig into these issues, not shy away from them, and that's exactly what we did. You'll hear from a number of GBH team members hosting these talks, and I'm quite proud of that. Our UK team is growing and our bench is deep. So for some of you, it'll be the first time you've heard from folks like Chris Hall, Johnny Garrett, and Claire Bullen, all led by our UK editor, Matthew Curtis. But it surely won't be the last. This episode is called A Change Can Do You Good, Keeping a Brand Fresh in a Dynamic Market. It still feels almost as though modern beer has only just arrived in the UK. The last decade has been a whirlwind, with once traditional and iconic beer brands being met by those with modern, vibrant, and striking designs. Brewers really are putting the can in canvas, but how do you maintain a modern image in such a dynamic market? And why rebrand when drinkers have already put their stock in your existing brand? This is hosted by myself, Michael Kaiser, with guests Nana Golbeck of Lervig, Nick Dwyer of Beavertown, and Sean O'Sullivan of 21st Amendment. Listen in. All right, welcome back. Thanks for joining us again. This panel is going to be devoted to branding and design. Branding in the broader sense of the term is going to include visual design, but we're also going to talk a little bit about a brand voice and sort of the larger story that you tell about your companies. On my left here, we have three folks that are very involved in the branding in different aspects of the breweries that they represent. To my left here, we have Nick Dwyer from Beavertown.
Woo!
In the middle, we have Nana Gulbeck from Lervig. Mm. We have Sean O'Sullivan from 21st Amendment.
Woo!
Thank you for that.
Yee-ha!
You've got to earn your woo.
Nana, I want to start with you because the other night while we were at Beer Merchants Tap, I was informed that a lot of the artwork that is scattered around the walls and tables and things is from your own hand. It was a bit of a surprise to me because I don't think of Lervig as being central to that kind of place and area, but it did start to make sense to me when I started to think about the connection that designers and artists and folks involved with brands have to each other between breweries. The same way that I think brewers sort of connect with each other from the production standpoint and find commonality there, so do, I think, designers and artists within breweries as well. Tell me how you came to be the person who created the artwork in Beer Merchants Tap.
Oh, well, I think Lervig and Beer Merchants has a really good relationship. And we always really work well with them. And they just approached me and said, like, we really like what you guys are doing right now, and we think your style will work really well with this venue. Like, would you be up for it? And I thought, yes, let's go for it. So
I think it's cool when a particular designer that's behind a brand, and sometimes there's more than one, I think it's interesting when their style becomes so iconic that other people want to put it on what they're doing as well, and they sort of fall in love with that. And we see that translation happen throughout. I mean, I see a very kind of clear connection, I think, in some of the sensibilities of the design that Lervig has in its brand by your hand and some of the things that Nick is doing and even 21st Amendment. There are some similar characteristics, I would say, in terms of like the looseness of the line work and the color schemes and things like that they seem interested in some similar things in what they're trying to achieve. Nick, how would you describe maybe some of the characteristics of the brand, the visual brand for Beavertown that that does have some commonality between these other two.
Well, firstly, I'm glad this led into this so easily, but it's so interesting that you said, and even 21st Amendment, because the whole reason that Beavertown cans look the way they do is 21st Amendment.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, when on the kind of fateful day when Logan came in with the kind of old branding wrapped around a Coke can and the original Gamma Ray label wrapped around a Coke can and was like, we need to do this, I think, if we're going into cans. He'd also just come back from America and he'd seen your cans and he's like, they've just got the name of the beer so clearly and it's woven into the branding and it's drawn and it's not, you know, there's nothing about it that's kind of just like, you've got a designer and then you've slapped the name of the beer onto it. It's very much all a part of it. And I think that's something that's one of the things that I think is common throughout all three of the things is that it's something that's really considered and really careful. And especially like Nana, with all your like video work and stuff, like when I went to the Beer Merchant's Place in Manchester, there's the videos on the wall that are very similar and link into the beer and get it all to kind of flow together. So the crux of it, I think, is that all three of our brands aren't just about looking pretty. But that's what we're trying to do. You know, I think that all three of us can agree that it's what gets people to gravitate towards the beer and take a chance on it or recognize it. But at the same time, it's way more about having the whole thing being cohesive, and then it's much easier to talk about it being a part of the beer as well. It's much less, you know,
yeah,
a designer.
I think like when I started working with Lervig, it was about how can we make this beer recognizable without having the name on it. Like how can people look in a can and say, well, this is actually a Lervig beer, without them even knowing the name of the brewery or seeing the name of it. And I think we're kind of getting there. Like now I see on social media, I see people posting cans and stuff and saying like, oh, like people recognize it just by the characters on it, which is really cool. We're starting to get there now.
Why do you think that's important?
I think it's important in the way that I just don't think that the name is like, it's just really cool that people see it from, like, whenever people take different pictures of the beers, and, or whenever you go to, like, as you say, if you go to Beer Merchants, people see something on the walls, and, like there's those small connections in it, which is just really cool.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's a different set of priorities, and I'm going to ask you about this, because I think you've been at it longer in this regard. There's a different set of priorities in the visual communication of craft beer compared to what beer has historically been. And I'm going to come back to you in a minute because I want to talk about the transition that Lervig has made. But going from something much more conventional in terms of its hierarchy of communication of like, this is the name of the brewery, this is the style of beer, and here's, you know, maybe a small bit of artwork to differentiate it. Something like 21st Amendments, especially, you know, Heller High Watermelon, for example, has become holistically an identifiable can. To the point where it's almost become its own breakaway story. It seems to me that craft brewers are much more comfortable having some elements of that communication take a back seat for the sake of the holistic picture, the gestalt of that becoming memorable.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because we didn't get there, you know, we fumbled our way there. I mean, our first cans were like Nico and I, my business partner and I, like photoshopped, and it was IPA and watermelon wheat. That was the name of the two beers that eventually became Heller High Watermelon and Brew Free or Die. And so the evolution of the design, you know, our next iteration with that was like and we started distributing our beer outside of our pub because initially it was just being like packaged in our pub, was a box that we thought would be kind of cool because we were like one of 10 breweries in the country that are putting a craft beer in a can. Now there's a lot more, I think. And so it had a little window so you could see the cans, you know, because we were putting it in a box and we wanted to make sure that people knew there were cans in there. And that was a folly because the package kept ripping open. So the latest iteration, which is the third iteration, we kind of talk about how these things evolve with breweries, is what you see today, which is the iconographic imagery that, you know, sort of like all stems from the idea of the 21st Amendment being the sort of historical, you know, note in history, you know, back in the 20s and 30s, and really allowed us sort of the permission to sort of play with this iconographic American imagery, of which you spoke of as like Lady Liberty, the Statue of Liberty, you know, sitting on the Golden Gate Bridge and Heller High Watermelon, as well as, you know, other images that we're using. So it's, and actually the irony about this whole thing, to keep going further, is that Joe Wilson is the artist that does all of our mainline beers, and he is an artist in England. So here's an English artist that's sort of doing this interpretation of, you know, Americana in a lot of ways. So for us, I mean, it was not a straight line to that, but it definitely, once we got there, it was like, oh, I think we've got this figured out.
I mean, more than just the personal satisfaction of seeing it all finally click together, what effect did it have on the brewery and your sales and your ability to market well?
Well, we package a lot of beer and we sell it in, you know, a lot of grocery stores and liquor stores with their, you know, canned beer, and so it had it absolutely did. I mean, it was like when you see the brand family up there, you know, you see these images of like Brew Free or Die, you know, or Hell or High Watermelon or any other ones. It's like they all look, there's a brand family that's really relevant. It seems like the art is very the same, the lines are very the same. We actually had a complete miss. We did a beer called Toaster Pastry, which was a beer that we brewed at our new brewery in San Leandro. It's a production brewery. It used to be a Kellogg's factory where they made Pop-Tarts. Well, we couldn't use Pop-Tarts because we sued Kellogg's. So we used the generic term called Toaster Pastry, and it initially was a 19.2 ounce can. There was some success with it. It was our first time into that package size. And so we'd won a couple of awards. So of course, what do you do when you win awards? Man, let's make more of it. And so we, you know, put it in a six pack and it sat up there with the same like design as what it was in the larger can. It didn't work at all and it failed. And because it didn't have that connection back to the rest of the brand. So I think it's like the three breweries up here, I think we're doing a great job of like really communicating the brand family. So when you see it on the shelf, you know it's from that brewery.
Yeah, I mean, the previous iteration, Nena, of Lervig, It was very obvious that everything was from Lervig because almost the entire design constituted the logo sort of front and center on the label.
Yeah.
And they were much more simply designed. When you start to reinvent that brand and its visual style, and you start to bring in more of these sort of artistic elements that kind of decentralize that communication, What are some of the challenges that are posed to you from a visual standpoint of making sure they do all align as a portfolio, that they do kind of complete a set one way or another?
I think right now Lervig is still like in a transition stage where we have quite a bit of like the old range is still around. And it's, when I started working with Lervig, we were like a bit nervous about how will people take it? Like how will they react to like this change? But it's only been positive. Like, people have only reacted positive to it. And even like when you see like the mix of the different beers, I think you just see like the change that Lervig has been through in some way because it tells a story with the different labels. We're definitely moving towards having like a more like similar portfolio, but I don't mind that the old beer is sticking around because it's like they tell a story in their own way.
And Nick, for you, I mean, what you're kind of talking about as a group, I think, is a little bit of, you know, rather than just trying to communicate about one product that goes out into the world, you're trying to create a small world through design from one label to another, from one can to another, that over time maybe tells a bigger story about who the brand is. Maybe you don't get that, you know, initial simple communication point, but over time you get a much more interesting and rich communication.
Well, I think what was something that I kind of like, I saw it happen and then I was like, right, I'm gonna tap into that way more. I like that when people were starting to be like, hey, that's clearly inspired by Thunderbirds, or that's clearly inspired by, you know, all the kind of other kind of sci-fi, and it's kind of an easy win. Like skeletons and spacemen are kind of like, that's cool. And people will always say that to you and you can go, yeah, and feel good about it. But with that as well, and I think it's interesting you have an English artist creating Americana, because I am an English artist trying to emulate kind of American style beer artwork as well.
It's like backwards,
yeah, it's kind of crazy. I think trying to create something that people can really tap into and kind of get the references for and also feel a massive part of it is really good. And I'm just like champing at the bit to do a graphic novel or a comic or something like that. I just need some time to do that using the characters and things like that. And I've started to do more things like that. But yeah, I think that's just, it's just more the relatability. And you can kind of create a fan base of people who, like I said, see it and recognize it. And they're like, oh, what's happening now in the world of the spaceman or the skeleton? And what's going on in this kind of diorama?
That's how when I first started looking into like what I got to know Beotown. That was definitely the way that Nick has created like a universe. And like what he's done with that, I was like so intrigued with it. I thought it was so cool because it's so recognizable, and you feel like it's just like, as you say, it's like it feels like it should be like a comic or a movie. And I even see, I think I mentioned him a couple of times before, but like left-handed giants, who has like James Yu as a designer. I thought they were like brand new when I met them, when I saw their labels. When I actually got to meet the founders, I'm like, no, we've been around for like a few years. But it was first when James started working with them that I actually noticed their designs and got to like, you know, recognize it. So it's crazy how important like the branding has. And
Nana, when you also just a minute ago when you were saying that in the transitional phase between having the old branding and the new branding, do you mean that maybe there's someone who's not letting go of the old branding?
In some way, maybe.
Does that question come from a deep place inside yourself, Nick?
Yeah, definitely. I think, because of course people are always, I think, a bit nervous about the transitioning and how people take it. So, yeah. And there are, like, I meet people who still have, like, oh, like, what happened to this design? I really like that. Or, so people have quite a strong opinion about what you do and how it used to look like, which you meet all the time, you know.
But don't you think, like, some of it is, like, we're so close to the windshield in a lot of this. Mm. Like, I sometimes, like, I get frustrated because, oh, we're going to have another U.S. dead president on the label, you know. And you realize, like, well, that sort of resonates with the rest of the brand. But in general, it's like, I'm tired of seeing that. Like when I look at, you know, when I look at your stuff, I mean, it's like, well, this is really refreshing and all that. And you're like, well, yeah, we're doing this.
Yeah.
You know, this is what we live with all the time. But I think you have to be like true to your brand in a sense where you cannot deviate too much. We have a beer called El Sully. It's a Mexican lager. It's actually named after me, which is kind of cool. It has 1 foot outside of like our brand. And we're actually going to fix it because I think there's some confusion there.
I personally often forget that beer is one of yours.
And you're speaking exactly to our concern is that we need to fix that. And we're going to do a little rebranding on that, even though I like the way it looks now. But it doesn't speak to like what we're doing overall.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that, you know, skulls and astronauts, like, of course everybody loves it, but of course everybody loves it in a very small bubble. When that thing shows up on a grocery store shelf in a suburb somewhere that's never heard of Beavertown, I don't think the first reaction from everybody that shops there is, I love that. The first reaction is curiosity or a tilt of the head or, is this beer? There's a lot of different kinds of reactions from different kinds of people as your audience grows or your potential audience grows. So how do you, as a designer who's created this world that really works and it's created attachment with a fan base. Once you step beyond that fan base, what are some of the things that you're thinking about as a designer as to what you have to consider going forward?
I think it comes down to like always being ready with the story. I'm definitely not speaking for you guys when I say this, but like my starting out and like passion at the beginning came from like almost pure belligerence and just wanting people to think my drawings were cool. I just had like complete tunnel vision on it, and I was like straight out of art school, where it's like a competitive environment and everyone's always there looking at all these cool things and getting all these cool gigs that you think you should be getting. And I was like, I'm gonna put them on cans and loads of people are gonna have to look at them because they're drinking this beer. And then it turned around when I started to get kind of what Logan and James at the time was kind of doing. And I was just like, whoa, actually there's way more to life than just cool drawings. And you guys have your own thing and I want to be a part of that too. And it changed from wanting people to think my drawings are cool to wanting people to think that my understanding of what was going on was cool way more. And I wanted it to be, like, to begin with, people would be like, well, explain this to me. And I'd be kind of caught off guard. And I'd be like, it's spacemen. And they're fighting other spacemen. And people would be like, yeah, but like, why is it called Gamma Ray, the beer and all this kind of stuff? And then like the guys at the brewery would have an answer for that. And I'd be like, okay, right, next time someone asks me, I'm going to have something. And then I kind of go through all the beers. And like Smogrock, for example, contains German malt and has, luckily, German planes on the label, completely by accident. And it's made in London, and London is on the label. So it was like, that was just one of those things where I could like hook into it and be like, I had a story ready. So people who see it on the shelf, like you're saying, and go like, well, that's weird, why are you doing that? Firstly, they're not really my audience, and I tend to ignore them a lot. But at the same time, if they are going to say that, I'll be like, well, if you don't like it, I'm sorry. But like, this is kind of the reason we're doing it. It's, to begin with, the very pinnacle of it was that the style of beer was kind of a new thing that we were kind of like taking from the Americans, as it were, and kind of making our own in our own way. So that's where the kind of origins of it from. And then the tentacles of it kind of grew out like that. So yeah, to answer your question, it's like being ready with an explanation and not just going like, well, you should think it's cool.
I remember like starting working with Lervik also, where they were in the beginning, it would be, oh, Nana, can you have like this ready in like next half hour? And I'd be like, no.
Can you knock up? That's my favorite.
Yeah. Can you just sketch up this quickly? And it's like, no, that's not how it works. Sorry. And I think when they started to work with me, they kind of realized like how much effort I actually put into it and tried to like gather like what kind of beer is it and what were your thoughts about it and like how do we implement this into the label. And the more I work with them, I think Lervik has really realized like what kind of how much thought I put into it, which is so cool. To see how both Lervik has developed, but also the artwork.
Yeah, I mean, each of you have kind of talked about, I think, the attachment that your audience can have to something. And when you refresh a brand, you sometimes end up leaving some people or disappointing them or they miss the old thing to some degree. It doesn't mean they stop being fans, but, you know, there's a little bit of that tension of letting go. But the upside of that, of course, is that the potential to attract new and different audiences throughout the life of the brand. In the last refresh that each of you had, let's start with you, what were some of the considerations you had in mind for what you wanted that, who you were trying to connect with and the job the artwork had to do to get there?
Well, most recently, we kind of had a line extension with our mainline IPA, our West Coast style IPA, which is called Brew Free or Die. And we did a beer called Blood Orange Brew Free or Die. And so the packaging of both those beers are very similar. It's Mount Rushmore with Abraham Lincoln like busting through the wall. And if you looked at them, the cue was very vague. And so the refresh on that was, let's have Abe busting through the wall from a different angle, like a slight different angle. So a little bit of a refresh on that. And then having on the blood orange version have, you know, orange slices kind of, you know, with, you know, orange juice kind of squirting through the air in George Washington's eyes and all that. And then the other one was the Brew Free or Die was having hops there. Because when you saw them on a shelf, it was like a complete miss on our part, honestly. You want to talk about your failures? Was having those two side by side, and it just didn't work. So the refresh on that was to sort of like put these cues, hops, and, you know, orange slices, blood orange slices. And also, and now we're kind of morphing in through another refresh. We're essentially just changing a little bit of the angle, like kind of just, it's just a little bit more different orientation of what the cue points are. And so that's...
Towards what end? What are you trying to achieve with that?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is, I think, you know, you want to get the lockup right. You want to get, like, you want to maybe focus on more of a key character in some ways. And so, and how that would translate on your can as well. Maybe have just Abe Lincoln on the can. That hasn't happened yet, but that could potentially happen.
That reminds me of what Gamma Ray itself has kind of gone through as an evolution a bit, where in my mind, it went from being more of a scene that was painted to being more of a specific character that you would remember that got larger and more centralized.
The layout of Gamma Ray hasn't really changed, so it's just that it went from being the kind of like Dan Dare style, kind of like too child friendly drawing to like skeletons, not child friendly, so that didn't really change very much. So the kind of like refresh of Gamma Ray, which was like, I mean, like I don't like it when people are like, you changed it and I don't like it because you changed it and that's why they didn't like it. But I was very like careful about Gamma Ray not changing as much as humanly possible just because it's something that people really, really resonated with people and I didn't want to mess with it too much. Like Neck Oil, changing Neck Oil was like a huge thing. And there was a lot of backlash from that, and it was, that's one of the only times I've been like, is this going to work? Are people going to still think that this is the right decision to do and things like that? But it did. The landscape was kind of the most important part of it, and the fact that it kind of had a similar landscape to Gamma Ray and then it now flowed and it wasn't just the people. Because before it was obviously the people who had got us to that point, and everything was kind of changing as well in the brewery, and it was kind of time to move away from it. But I'm just trying to think. The refreshes have been, it's been interesting the way people think about it, because if people are specifically like, I don't like that you changed this because I really liked this about the first one, then I'm like, oh God, actually, you know, that will give me pause for thought. And be like, ah. But then I genuinely do feel like there is a large contingent of people who just like to be able to go, right, that's that. And then when it's changed, they're like, what?
Yeah.
And that really irks them and throws them through a loop.
But it seems like on the product side of beer, like the beer itself, people, sure, they might not want specific beers to change over time, but they always want new and fresh things coming. And so there is this kind of tension, I think, between wanting things to stay the same and then wanting them to constantly change at the same time. I mean, how do you decide when it's time for a refresh? What are some of the factors involved in you deciding that it's worth changing things up now?
I think what Sean is saying is kind of like when you, if there's one that stands out and that you're kind of like, well, why isn't that one doing what all these other ones are doing? Or when they're all in a line together.
It's also like, you know, we create like, it's almost, I think when we create a package, it's like we look at the box first in some ways. And then the can so much, not so much set, because that's how, what's what you see on the shelf. And so I think now we're going through a process where we're like, well, does the can really have to be the overall graphic of what the box is? And so that's our...
So you're starting to kind of treat them as separate objects now with different purposes.
Exactly. It's like, you know, the can have the focus on Lady Liberty, or the can have the focus on Abraham Lincoln. It doesn't have to be the entire scene. Like, it's almost kind of an old school way of doing it, like going the other direction. I think what we're lucky here is that the great thing about, you know, cans and boxes is that you can kind of like, you have this great billboard effect that occurs, where with bottles, you don't have that effect.
I think you see it also now when both with, especially maybe in UK, where there's quite a big scene of also like the festivals more and more, there's quite a lot of branded stuff. And like Indie Man, you have like rooms where breweries can like create their own like universe, and more and more breweries are opening up their own bars, which is quite interesting because all of a sudden you have like a completely new layer to like how do people see us, and what do we want to create with this space, which is also really interesting to see how that kind of develops with more and more breweries opening.
Have you been involved in designing the physical spaces for Lervik?
No, only for festival events. Yeah, we're doing something for Indie Man this year, which I think is going to be really exciting.
And how is that a different experience for you from designing packaging? Like, what are you thinking about that's a very different kind of task?
I actually come from like a product design background, so for me it's quite interesting to actually all of a sudden working with more like three-dimensional objects, and I've kind of missed that for a long time. Because even though, of course, like when I work with labels, I tend to print them out and like work with them on the can quite a lot, because I enjoy, well, how is it actually to hold it in your hand? Like, what kind of textures do you feel? What do you see when you turn it around? It's not just like a flat surface. So all of a sudden, to work with a space, I think you can just engage with the users on a completely different level, because all of a sudden you can work with textures and colors and smell and sound in a completely different way.
Yeah. And there's something that happens in every brewery's life, I think, when they have to make a decision of whether or not they want to continue doing exactly what they've been doing and sort of become classic in a way, or become extremely familiar to a large set of people, or continue to change and evolve in a much more dramatic sense. I've heard Tony McGee talk about the history of the Lagunitas branding, and he's like, you don't become classic by changing things. So he was very adamant about not changing things, even though they were the same shitty labels he designed in a Kinko's, you know, by himself.
It was so sad when I found out that dog was just a piece of clip art, and not like a dog they had at the brewery or anything. It's exactly. Just a piece of clip art they found.
Yeah, it was probably already part of like a suite of clip art that was on the machine in the Kinko's when he grabbed it. But it's become classic because he did not change a thing. You know, over time, he's been very, very adamant about not changing things. For better and worse, probably. In your mind, how do you think about that relative to your own brand? Like, how steadfast do you feel towards what is now in existence, and how open to, you know, some bigger dramatic changes do you feel coming in the future? How are you going to think through that problem?
Well, I think that I'm in a really good position with Beavertown in that we have a core range of beer, and that means that we can, I've got like a basis, a kind of almost like a platform on which to kind of leave it. And so it's actually, like, you know, it's very easy for me to now say, right, that's that core range of six beers is totally fine, and we don't need to touch that unless it needs to change for any other legal reason. And then we get to do all these specials and collabs and stuff like that. So we can kind of keep that how it is, and it kind of does it itself. I don't have to kind of sit there and watch it going, come on, get classic. it will just sit there, and if it does or it doesn't, is just down to, you know, time will tell, essentially.
Yeah.
But then I get to experiment and play around and do, like, you know, all the kind of crazy stuff that we do on the labeled cans, and again, play with textures and shiny bits, and yeah, really draw people to it. So yeah, for me, that's kind of an easy one. But yeah, I mean, how do you feel with the kind of like changing, moving forward and stuff?
Good. well, I don't know. Well, I've been working with Lervik for now, like, a year, like in the way that what I'm doing now. So well, 2 years we've started working with them. So we haven't really redone any of my new labels yet. I think it's good. Change is good. I don't mind it.
But you speak about it with a certain sense of practicality now. You seem, you know, healthily removed from the sort of the need of the packaging to be commercialized and perform well. But were you, did you always feel that way? Were you always able to remove yourself from the artistic process enough to accept change?
No. I mean, you know, it's interesting because Ben Kinser, who does all our design work, and he works with all the artists and the illustrators and all this, and he worked for a marketing advertising company in Bend, Oregon, and then they went out of business, so we hired him, and actually things took quicker and cost less, which was great, because we had the guy that was actually doing all the work. But, you know, we're, I think, again, going back to the, your nose is so close to the brand in a lot of ways, I think you become like, can we do something else, you know? We have this series called the Insurrection Series, where we actually get to put our foot completely outside of the brand, and like it's a small run thing, so the batches are relatively small. We just did a collaboration with Fieldwork Brewing Company in Berkeley, which is right there in, you know, the Bay Area, called A Terrible Idea. It's a hazy idea because in some ways it's a terrible idea to put a hazy IPA in a can. and so, but that art is completely different. I mean, you look at it and it's actually gonna sit in a variety pack. And if you look at all the, you know, it's all our iconic labels, and then you have this one label and it's a little bit different, but it's almost like an Easter egg in some ways. It's like, oh, this is something different. So what happens in those instances, though, is when that beer becomes popular, we sometimes want to put them into the, you know, to the overall brand family, and so then we'll end up changing the packaging. We did that with a beer called Tasty IPA, which was this iconic home brewer, Mike McDowell, Tasty, and then we wanted this beer to live on in a six pack, in a larger, and also in a 15 pack. And so we morph his image, his cartoon image that was in the Insurrection series, and now it's Ben Franklin sitting in like a sea of hops, which the impetus was American Beauty, that image there with the flowers that were floating, the roses that were floating down on that gal that was in the laying.
That's a layered image.
It is.
That's a lot going on there.
Yeah, I don't know if everybody got that. That's why I had to explain it in great depth.
Sounds way sexier.
Like
it's a large man in hops, so you right. know, at the end of the day.
So brewers.
It's like beer festivals. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, some of the changes that come through either a brand, some of the things that come as a change to a brand are often from outside factors as well. The way that packaging has changed within craft beer over the last 5 years has been massively disruptive. People not only have to translate from bottles to cans, but then it's a 16-ounce or a 12-ounce. It's a paper label versus a sleeve or a printed can and all these. And sometimes that's dictated not just by preferences, but what's available from a material standpoint in a market. We, you know, the U.S. is going through some pretty tough times with 16-ounce cans for some smaller producers right now. And they're starting to think, well, does that mean I have to go back to bottles? What does that mean now? And so to your point, Anna, about texture and designing in the round and thinking about the object of the thing itself, not just the two-dimensional sort of story that you're telling, what are some of the more particular challenges that you have in designing some of the objects now that we, you know, 12 and 16 ounce cans seem to be the more popular kind of trend in packaging, but a lot of Lervik's products are still in bottles. And how do you balance, I guess, how do you deal with dealing with actual different dimensional objects that way?
Well, more and more is getting into cans. We definitely, that's almost all the new beers we're doing are on cans, where all kind of textures, you can do all kind of varnishes. So that's what we prefer to work with.
Why is that? Is there a artistic advantage to the can?
Yeah, because the way that, first of all, is a bigger area to do artwork on, but also with the canning line we had at that point, it was only possible to use paper labels for our bottles, for example, and then in that way we couldn't use the same amount of different kind of textures and finishes on it. So now we just got a new canning line, actually, and here all of a sudden it's possible to use plastic labels, which again gives totally new possibilities. And I've been really happy with the place we work with, who does all of the labels, are really good at, like, yeah, because they know I love these things. So every time they have something new, they'll be like, hey, Nana, we got this thing. Like, what do you think about it? Or, which I love, because they know, you know, it's so cool to try new things. And yeah, whatever is on the market, I always say, like, just send me a sample. Send me a sample and see what it is. Because I love it.
Yeah. Nick, you did one of the more clever things I'd seen in a while. It was one of the first ones I'd seen to do it where for some of the special releases that are smaller runs where you can't really afford to make massive printed can runs, which are often 20 to 40,000 cans minimums, at least in
100.
The States. Yeah. You did a base printed can that has a pattern on it that's black, and then did a paper label over that sort of integrated with that, with the overall can. How did that process come about, or that idea come about with you and the team?
I kind of forget. For those of you who've met Logan, is he even there? No. Good. he's a very specific man. And like they're the tiny details really stick out to him, and I think it came out of like being a bit of a puppy dog about that and wanting to be like, hey, look what I made happen. It all matches up and it looks good, right? Yeah. And so the printed can hasn't really changed very much at all. It's still the same pattern. And obviously I had that design, so that design just goes behind every design that goes onto the can. We send it to the label guys, and they have like a stock of these cans so they can match the black exactly and all that kind of stuff to get it spot on. I can't actually remember exactly why that was a big deal, but it seemed like a really easy thing to do. It just made sense really fast in my mind when they were like, well, we can't get printed cans for the specials. What are we going to do about that? Oh, let's just get a can that we use for every special that we label. And to begin with, there were a few misses. Like we changed the label for Beer Skull King a couple of times, for example, because using the varnishes meant that it didn't quite match and it looked really gray and it looked really light and it obviously was a label and it just looked really strange. Same with the beer called Lemon Phantom that we did. It's still one of my favorite labels that I've done, but it's not everyone else's favorite label. It's just one of those things that's like one of mine. But it came out in that way and it's really resonated with people to the point where people who collect up the labels have emailed us being like, I'm having a really hard time peeling off the Loopuloid label from the can. can you send me some Loopuloid labels? And we'll have to like try not to be like, you're an idiot. But it's like, it's been writing back to them being like, oh, we can send you some more cans. But yeah, so that was another thing to kind of engage with people about. It wanted to be another thing that people noticed, and they did. It was like a successful thing where people were like, oh, cool, yeah, you've labeled the can, that's really nice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that physical sensation and being someone who does those things early on, I think you end up getting a lot of credit from an experiential standpoint from people because they notice it because they haven't felt that on a can before. I mean, to pick that up, a can that looks printed, and then to feel the edge of the sticker, all of a sudden there's like another discovery of the actual physical journey of it being made, which is kind of interesting, even if it's just a necessity.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I also really like when people get intrigued by the label first and the artwork on it, but then when they take the can and then, you know, there's just another dimension to it, like, oh, it actually, there's a difference in textures, or the foil is cold and the rest has like some kind of like small, like wrinkly parts, or it adds a different dimension to the beer. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, kind of along those lines. I mean, there's the big phenomenon right now, I don't know if you see it here in the US, is like tap room, you know, breweries that just are selling most of their beer over the bar there are doing these limited runs 16-ounce cans. Mm-hmm. And it's like these pressure sensitive labels that go on there. And so they don't go all the way around and all that. And it's becoming huge. And I think from somebody who's printing a lot of cans all the time, and you see that, I think that actually resonates with the consumer because there's a craftiness to the whole thing. I mean, I think we should get into that. I think that, you know, I would like to do smaller runs, like smaller collaborations with other breweries where we don't have to like print up a bunch of, you know, cans.
What do you, this pressure sensitive just, is this pressure sensitive? Is that
yep.
like, just having a label? That's what that is.
It's, okay. But it's almost, doesn't even almost go all the way around. There's a lot of exposed like aluminum.
Right, it leaves, half to an inch.
I don't think there are very few breweries that have done anything but that ever, I don't think. Because like sleeves are kind of a very much a niche thing.
We're seeing a little bit more of the sleeve technology coming in here, but what's really popular is this company called Canvan, which is in the Bay Area, and it's, you know, they go out and they will, you know, roll up to your brewery, and then they'll turn on their canning line and, you know, essentially run the beer. So that nobody owns the can.
Well, what's fascinating about that is that it starts as a physical or a financial constraint.
Yeah.
And then when enough small producers do it, it becomes an aesthetic that has a bigger meaning. And so
exactly.
When you see a can with that kind of physical label on it, you start to associate it with small local producer. This must be fresh. This must be interesting or innovative. And those things start to develop their own sort of aesthetic and language to the point where then larger companies see that and are like, well, we should start going with lower grade materials. And we want people to think about our beers.
It's not so much lower grade materials. I think it's because it's just the economy of scale. So if you,
sure.
you know, to, you know, to produce this can, it's a lot better if you buy a lot of it.
Right.
And so, you know, but you sometimes can't do that when you're doing projects with other breweries where you can't make a whole lot of beer because maybe it doesn't work with what other program you're doing. So you want to be able to sort of like do something more on it, scalable at a lower level.
When you think about the future, this is going to be my last question before I turn it over, but when you think about the future, right now, all of your brands are highly relevant, very contemporary, and people associate them with what's happening right now. They're very cultural that way and very relevant. How are you going to prevent becoming a brewery that's like, oh, that's such a 2015 brewery? when we look back on it. Because I mean, you look at labels now, and like you're just like, oh, that's such a '90s craft beer.
We are killing beers. That's what we're doing.
Say it again.
We are killing some beers that are not like, they're kind of at this line where like, well, maybe we can't make it anymore, and the popularity's gone down, and the goal is to replace them with something new. So we're getting rid of Back in Black, which is a black IPA, I mean, and also Down to Earth, which is a session IPA, because I think the session trend in the U.S. is kind of downturning a little bit. Pale ales are kind of coming up more. And so,
the monkey. That's my favorite.
I know. I'm sorry, but maybe we'll revisit. It's talking about ham.
I don't like that change.
Yeah, I don't either. Actually, believe me, I talk to Dave Wilson, our president, all the time. I'm like, really, you're killing this beer?
No, I think it's constantly changing.
You have to play to it.
Yeah, and even I couldn't do the same thing like over and over again. So I think personally, we also develop. So it's like, of course, it will also develop the way we do. And looking to breweries like Tor Ull or Mikkeller, which I know quite well, it's. Both of them have done really well in like keep developing what they're doing. So, yeah, I'm not so nervous about that.
So somebody in my last talk that I did told me that in order to stay relevant, I needed to die.
No.
Fuck. You're like, all the good ones do.
Kill beers, like, kill people.
Okay, yeah, kill people. Yeah, I don't know. That's actually quite a hard question for me. I guess just like, I mean, the reason that I like to change so much is when I see things kind of creeping up that are similar. I like to go into overdrive and make them make it further and more, well, what I like to think is better, but just different and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm not really, you get kind of taught at art school, I'm sure you had this too, that like, there will be people, you should copy people, people will copy you. It's just all about making sure that you're either ready for that or at least you're differentiating yourself enough that it's not just like, hey, I'm gonna do that too. It's like,
it's always gonna be, yeah, there's always gonna be people who copy each other. And it's, I think, yeah, always just stay fresh and do your own thing.
And don't go after them. They don't sit there being like, stop copying me. It's like, fine,
just do something better and different. Yeah, for sure.
Thank you. Let's do some Q&A. Who's got a question? We have one right over here.
Hi, guys. So I guess it's addressed to all of you. What advice would you give to someone like myself, who's a marketing manager for a brewery, to sort of work with designers and artists such as yourselves to create, to be able to collaboratively create you know, work that you guys are proud of, but also perhaps, you know, efficiently, especially with timescales in mind.
Well, that's interesting because a lot of people associate design with marketing, but they're not always the same kind of product that's being produced in the end, or the same people doing those things. Yeah, that's great. How do you think about that?
Well, I think the biggest kind of killer is having too much of an idea of what you want before you approach a designer. Because you are basically penning them into something that will frustrate both you and them, like, endlessly. Because if you get someone who is kind of a big thinker, or like they're the sort of person that thinks their first idea is their best idea, they'll just be like, no, and you'll be like, well, no, and they'll be like, well, no, and it'll just, that's how that will work. So it's very much a case of that. And in the same vein, if you haven't seen it happen before, don't let that scare you. Like, if it's something that somebody's showing you and you're like, I've never seen that on a can before, don't be like, well, let's try that. I think that you should always do that.
What do you want to know about an assignment? What is the most helpful pieces of information that someone can give you to set you off in a productive direction without boxing you in?
I mean, I think for us, I mean, Ben, who manages our design process, I mean, he presents us with like four directions. And he goes like, well, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? And we kind of like, we stew on it, and then we kind of go like, this is the direction we want to go on for this particular beer. And it actually kind of sets the assignment up, and so we have an idea of where we want to go. So eventually when we go to an illustrator, we already have had the conversation, so it's not like we're just throwing something at some, you know. So we really depend on that initial conversation to sort of drive the show in the direction of where we're going to go with a particular label.
I mean, do you prefer to know the name and the beer style and things like that? Is that how it have to be baked in?
All of the information.
Dana says no.
I'm good with that. Sometimes I just like, if I know the beer style and what the brewers want to do with it, sometimes the name comes with artwork. It's not, because sometimes if I know what the name is and the story behind it, I think I would get very, like, okay, well, we need to do something in this way, where not having a name or not knowing the thoughts behind the beer, not style-wise, but thought-wise, can give me a completely different result, which I like, and because I think it creates something different. In the beginning, I think I did a mistake when I started working with it. I always like just presented that, like just a raw sketch, and like, what do you think about this? And they'd be like, well, I hate green. or something like really general. So now I'm getting better at just saying, like, what do you think about this idea or this concept or these kind of things, which is good.
Yeah, I also think it's like, you know, we have a new beer coming out, and we already know what the beer is, and we don't have a name, and we don't even have an image yet, and it's like that. I don't think it's always as linear as you want it to be. It's like definitely there's a convoluted way the way you get to the end. It's not rocket science. It's a lot of it is a lot of emotion. A lot of it is like, I don't like green. You know, luckily the three owners were like, they call us the three-headed monster, and so we're literally like, they're having to deal with that constantly, you know, Ben and his team. So, but you get there.
We have another question.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Joel from White Bear Brewing. I guess my question is, in terms of branding, do you ever feel that you're potentially crossing a line with anything that you might be, like, what is the line between potential tongue-in-cheek humor and going too far? So, for Lervik especially, you did a Sour Susie, where she had her middle finger up. And for something like Omnipollo Buxton collab, where they had Yellow Belly, what would you say was the line between humour and just between, not acceptable? Or have you ever been close to that line or considering crossing that line? Or
Well, we had, I did a label last year, November or something, called Liquid Sex Robot, which, I think that was what you were thinking for, maybe, which was like, when we made that label, after some time, I got, there was someone calling it out on Twitter and saying, like, we don't want to buy this sexist shit. We don't want to support you, Lervik. Like, what the fuck are you doing? And I took it really personal, because I think what I do, like, when people look at my portfolio as a whole, I really try to not focus on gender, and I don't, because, yeah, I don't think it's good to do that. And I did quite a long story on Instagram just to, like, telling, like, my point of view and why it was made for this label and what the thoughts was behind, because I thought it was important, because I totally get where that person came from, but I just don't think it was appropriate for this label, because, yeah, that was not what we were going for at all. And luckily, people really took it really well. I think when they saw my response to it and the support we got, I think, and the conversations it got afterwards also, it went really well. And even like today, it's a label, whenever I go anywhere, it's a label that people, they ask me about it, and like, oh, like the sex robot, what was up with that? And we had the conversation at our brewery about what can we put on a label and not. So it turned into a thing that's actually been really cool in the way that actually breweries are like talking about also, like, how do we approach this, and like talking about gender and these kind of things. So it's actually become quite an iconic label, at least to my work.
We've had the conversation has sort of come to a head on a lot of those issues lately in design and branding for breweries specifically.
Which is good.
And some of them are complex conversations around an idea that's sort of complex or layered, and then other ones are really pointed because the idea that was put on the label is fairly blunt and maybe a bit dumb. And I think breweries are starting to now ask themselves, how do we prevent making this kind of mistake? Or if we want to do something and we believe in it, how do we make sure that the story is more available to people? What are the ways, do you have any ways in which you've talked internally as creatives with your teams that help you get a larger picture of how somebody might read into something that you're making?
I don't like really super. I kind of took a step back from like naming beers. Like, you know, you were saying you don't like to know about the beer. Mm. But what tends to happen at Beavertown is that the beer will get brewed, and there'll be a lot of ideas around a concept for a name, and then I'll learn the name and go follow the brewers around a bit and maybe try and get that influence. But what something that really annoys me and I kind of have to bite my tongue about sometimes is I think that tongue-in-cheek joke names for beers have like no longevity at all. I think they're funny in the moment, and then they're never iconic or they never stick with you. So that's just my kind of take on like kind of silly tongue in cheek. So that's the other side of what we're talking about. Because I mean, you dealt with that, like the sex robot thing really well. And you were like, look, this is a bigger conversation. And you know, you said to them, you said it in a very, very good way, but it was essentially like, you're just being annoyed for the sake of being annoyed with this one. The energy doesn't need to be here. It needs to be in the right place. This is the wrong place for that energy.
Because there are a lot of shit labels out there. So it is an important talk. And I think the talk afterwards here is probably going to be interesting for that. So,
I mean, do you ever... how do you get outside of your own head for that kind of feedback on something, whether it's the name of something or the visual for it, to decide if you are coming close to that edge, as you described, how do you stoke a dialogue internally before it gets to market as to whether this is appropriate or not?
Well, there's always like a great, like, I think there's, designing by committee is dangerous. I think you have to have a thought leader, you know, somebody like you two, like, where are we going? Like, what is the direction here? Because if you get too many, you know, cooks in the kitchen, it can be very muddled in what the vision and the message is. So, but what we'll do is, I think when we get to a certain level and we feel really confident about it, we'll bring in like sales and start saying, hey, this is the direction, because you don't want to get too much feedback, because it can stall the effort, and then you end up going down a way that you, you know, a place you don't want to go.
Yeah, I mean, there's a double-edged sword there. Design by committee is that could be the death of a brand.
Yeah.
But not having people other than yourself in the room to reflect on those things can also be how you miss really obvious cues that aren't apparent to you, you know, either because of your background or, you know, because you've been too close to it for too long. You can really miss an outside perspective on things, especially when we're talking about what's appropriate or what's potentially controversial for the wrong reasons.
I think as a company, we've actually opened up the process, especially with can designs, label designs, to a larger group. It used to be just three of us in a room going like, I like that, you know, that kind of thing. And now I think we have more of an eclectic like group, but a tight group. We don't want to have it be too big, because then egos get involved and people like, well, I like the green, you know, and you're like, well, I don't like green, you know, and that it becomes like, it stalls the effort.
That's all that we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us for that. That was really enlightening. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, folks. We hope to see you at the Extravaganza again next year. Who knows what lies ahead for the industry, its culture, and the many challenges and opportunities that will present themselves along the way. But sure enough, we'll be ready to dig in and talk about it from a variety of perspectives around the world. And the Beavertown Extravaganza will be the perfect venue for it. Aim true, pour liberal. We'll see you next year.